Welcome to Women Worth Knowing, the radio program and podcast hosted by Cheryl Broderson and Robin Jones Gunn.
Robin, it's so fun to see you in studio. We've had a little hiatus there, and we're really excited about today's episode. As you know, Robin and I are fascinated by a Christian women who have just these amazing stories. And every woman that you meet who knows Jesus has the most fascinating story. And we love exploring them when we get together in studio.
Today, we had to have our friend Michelle Yule come back. She is a biographer extraordinaire.
She really is, yes.
And so we invited Michelle to come because she has been working on research of a woman I'd never heard of. Now, you had heard of her.
Yes.
And Michelle, we just want to welcome you back and say, just jump right in and tell us about this woman worth knowing.
Oh, I love that. Did you see that?
Yeah. Yes.
Like, this is going to be fun. She rubbed her hands together. Yes.
Like, I've been waiting for this.
Uh-huh. Well, I ran into Pandita Ramabai when I was doing my original research on Oswald Chambers, because it seems like everybody I research ends up with Oswald Chambers somehow. One of his students ultimately went and worked with Pandita Ramabai in India and ended up running the mission she established for a number of years. So it's so interesting. And they're all holiness movement people. So who knew that the holiness movement was so wide across really the world. It wasn't just limited to England and the United States, but it moved all over. And, you know, the Holy Spirit moved and God was at work. And many people are in heaven today as a result of that movement.
Well, we are looking forward to hearing her story. But give us a time. So this is India, and it's the mid-1800s when she
was
born?
She was born in 1858 outside what is now called Pune. And Pune is about, 60 miles east of what is now called Mumbai, but at that time was called Bombay.
Right.
If I mix those names, I'm sorry. People, I think, in the West are more familiar with Bombay, but
I think so.
Who knows? Pune now is a major high-tech place, but it wasn't in 1858 or throughout the 19th century.
Okay, start us at the beginning.
All right, 1858, she was born the youngest of six children to a Hindu Brahmin scholar. Brahmins are the highest caste of Hindu scholars. And she was born, probably 120 miles northeast of Pune, which is basically north central India. And she was the youngest child of, I think, ultimately six. But her father, as a Brahmin scholar, was just fascinated and became completely convicted that women needed to be educated. They needed to be taught to read, that they could handle the Sanskrit scholars or the Sanskrit Puranas, which are the verses, just as well as any man can. And of course, in Obosh 1820, when he was writing this, which was right after the British, who were in colonial control of India at the time, had outlawed suti, which is where the widows of men were thrown on the funeral pyre and immolated. They died when their husbands died. Mm-hmm. That's what they did. So that was, again, a Hindu culture that had gone on for a long time. And Anant Dhonje is his name, actually showed in scripture that was against the Hindu scriptures as well as the non-education.
Okay, so when we're talking about the scriptures and all of these, is this what's contained in the Bhagavad Gita?
I don't know. It was always referred to as the Puranas or the Vedas. The Vedas were the verses, I believe, of the Sanskrit Puranas. Mm-hmm. So they argue, just like we argue biblical theology now. He felt so strongly about this, however, that he said, fine, I'm going to marry a 9-year-old. I'm going to take her out and I'm going to teach her how to read and I will prove my point.
Well, now, that might sound virtuous to him, but for us, our listeners, they're like, what a way to prove a point, you know? Let me marry a 10-year-old, you know? 9-year-old in his case, yes.
Fortunately, he found, if you will, a very brilliant 9-year-old whom he taught how to read. He taught her the scriptures. And this woman, who's probably really the heroine of the whole thing, was so industrious that she kept right up with him. She studied the scriptures at night after she was done cooking, cleaning, bearing all these kids, and went right with it. So all of his children, and that included daughters, were raised with the Hindu scripture. And at that time, the the scriptures are written in Sanskrit, which the common person generally did not speak. There's a lot of dialects across India, who knows how many. Their particular family up near Bombay were speaking Marathi, and that was the family language. But he taught all of his kids the same thing. And that youngest one, Ramabai, by the age of 12, could recite 18,000 Vedas from memory. Okay, so that's 18,000 verses from scripture, basically.
Wow.
I can't add. So anyway, totally shocked everyone that she was so talented. But it became a problem, and so he moved his family out into the jungle. They had a homestead. As good Sanskrit scholars, they invited anyone to come who could. And after 13 years, he went through all of his money. And the family only had these brilliant minds. And they basically just became wandering missionaries, if you will. Not even missionaries. They just became wandering scholars. Went from temple to wonderful place to palace where they would recite the scriptures, the Sanskrit, in Sanskrit, which the common people couldn't understand. Mm-hmm. But it was such a marvel that they would donate food. And that's what the family lived on for the last probably 15 years of their lives, wandering through the wilderness.
So he's wandering with his wife and all six of his children.
Some of the kids have been married off.
Okay.
Basically, he had three left with whom they wandered. And they went from the south of India all the way up towards the Himalayas, as far east as Calcutta and back to Bombay. They walked miles and miles and miles and apparently made a living. They didn't have any skills to do anything else, but that was sufficient until famine hit. And in 1875-ish, 76, a big famine raged throughout India, as they often do, unfortunately, at that time, waves of famine, and they began to starve. They had no money coming in. They had no place to go. He took them out into the jungle and said, "We are going to starve with honor out here in the jungle." So Pandita, or Ramabai, was about 16 at the time, and she sat and watched her father die. But before he died, he blessed all the members of his family. And this is what he said about his youngest child. He said, "Remember, my child, you are my youngest, my most beloved child. I have given you into the hand of our God. You are his, and to him alone you must belong and serve him all your life long." He died shortly thereafter, and over the next few months, the oldest daughter and the mom both died, leaving Ramabai and her brother, whose name was, I'm sorry.
Well, I have something where you look for that real quickly. It's because I know, you know, having studied Hindu in high school, that Hinduism has a pantheon of gods. I mean, they've got like over 1,000 gods. So when he's saying, "I bless you by..." You know, you're thinking about, is it Vishnu or is it, you know, Shiva and, you know, all the different gods. So that was really kind of very innocuous, wasn't it? Like, "I bless you by one of the gods," you know? Yeah, whichever God blesses, you know, not by the Zoroastrian god, but, you know.
Yeah. It sort of reminds you of Paul, right? When he was in Greece and there was the unknown god.
Mm-hmm. It does.
I don't know that Ramabai had any concept of that at the time, because that was all she knew. But there she was. She was 18. Her brother was 20, Srinivas. And they didn't know any other way of supporting themselves, so they began walking. Mm. And over the next 3 years, they walked 4,000 miles.
Wow.
Just repeating these Puranas. And as I said, she was just some sort of a marvel, 18,000 of them. They never had to explain what they meant. They just sat there and read them, and the people would give them whatever they had. And by then, again, famine was rampant. Mm-hmm. They ended up in Calcutta.
Now, I want to ask you one other question. I'm sorry to do this to you, but she is a woman, and she's reciting the Sanskrit, which was pretty unheard of. Was there any backlash at this time for this woman who would go to these places? You know, it would be definitely acceptable for her brother, but was it acceptable for her?
There's no indication there was. And in fact, by the time they got to Calcutta, which again is basically in Bangladesh now, she was considered a total marvel.
Okay.
And they actually kind of put her up in front of this group of Sanskrit scholars to prove that she could do this. And they talked to her and they listened to her, and she just went right through it. And they were so amazed that they decided that she would be a pandita. And then they also called her a Saravasti, I mean, a goddess of wisdom. I mean, mm-hmm. she truly was a marvel of it all. They were almost like, you know, they would take them, show them here and there, and they'd go to conversations and parlors, and they were feted for their brilliance. And
As a pandita, is she like the first of her kind, or had there been other panditas?
She was one of the first ever, and that's a female pandit, which is a Sanskrit.
Yeah.
And so that gave her a voice. But by this point, she and her brother, having, you know, walked all over India pretty much their whole life, they could speak seven languages. They knew all the dialects from all these places that they went. And they pretty much lost their faith in their Hindu gods. They didn't help them. They didn't support them. They were left starving. They had nothing else to do but to walk, recite the faith words. But it was not in their heart. They had pretty much disregarded it. Wow. And they were, in a sense, just jaded about the whole thing. So they were, in fact, she called themselves, we're basically atheists. We just hung out with the Hindu scholars. At this point, though, she adopted her father's beliefs that women should be educated. The British Raj was still in control of India at this time. And in 1829, which was before she was born, they had outlawed the tradition of Suti, which is when men died, their widows threw themselves on the funeral pyre and burned to death, self-immolation. And but it still went on. I mean, it went on. It may still go on for all I know, but it was no longer legal. The British government tried to control tradition, but how do you do that in a huge, huge country like India still is? But she began to speak in these gatherings there in Calcutta about the need for women to be educated. She insisted that women needed to have female doctors because they couldn't see male doctors, so they were dying young. The health and the quality of life for so many Hindu women at that time was just terrible. And then, of course, we had all of these child widows, so perhaps they weren't being thrown onto the Suti pyre. But now if like her parents, the widow is married at 9 to an older man who dies when she's, 11, what do you do with her? You know, does she go back to her family? His family doesn't want her because it's another mouth to feed. But what happens to her? So Ramabai was arguing, now she was a pandita. She was a renowned scholar, Pandita Ramabai. So she would argue that they needed to be educated, because as soon as you stopped educating her, you've thrown away her life. And that was finding footholds there in the Calcutta culture, particularly the British. They were pretty interested in what she had to say. And she just insisted that education would empower, and we needed to educate women. So there you go. And then she pointed out that child marriage, which was still going along, just ended any hope of education, and it needed to stop. It was such an interesting topic of discussion that even Queen Victoria heard about it, and she was well lauded for that.
So that's interesting when you consider her mother was 9, and she's speaking out against this, you know, child marriage. Now, also, too, you think that she's, you know, 20 or so. And so to be a single woman in that culture was was she perhaps able to survive or actually have some dignity? Because you know, from what I've read before, a woman that age at that time who was unmarried, therefore has no natural support, it was looked down on. And so.
Yeah. And her father had fielded lots of invitation proposals for marriage to such a smart kid, right? Mm-hmm. Smart woman. Sure. I don't know what they're going to do with her. Take her home and listen to her recite Puranas. But when her brother died, her father had said, no, she's going to be educated. When her brother died, though, when she was 20, she was then alone in the world. What did she do? Mm-hmm. They had met a Bengali lawyer, and he had been educated in a Christian missionary school. He was not a Christian in any way. He was a Hindu still. But they liked each other. He was of a lower caste, though. And so at that point, because she had jettisoned all of her faith, they just got married. Scandal. And lived there in Calcutta. She gave birth to a little girl. And he died when the baby was 4 months old.
Her husband died when the baby's 4 months old? Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. So much loss. It's hard to really plan for the future or think about what could be. And it would seem that her education was so steeped in the Hindu Sanskrit teachings. And then she's saying women should be educated. But there's so many other things women could be educated in, you know, various fields. So did, well, anyways, keep talking because I'm really curious how she...
You're processing.
I know how she was able to grow in that culture at that time. How she was able to flourish the way she did is just going to be fascinating. Keep going.
Well, actually, that's a really interesting observation, Robin, because the key to it all was she had a father who insisted she be educated, who saw nothing different between his daughter and his son in terms of education, and he was determined that his daughter would be educated. Obviously, he didn't anticipate dying when she was young. I'm sure he was basically looking for a wise, probably wealthy, man to marry her to when she came of age and of herself. I had a mother like that who insisted that I had to be educated equivalent to my brothers, that there was nothing different between me or them. And maybe you two, it did as well.
But, you know, it's interesting because that seems to be like a cord that runs through so many of the stories that we've told on Women Worth Knowing. And I think about like Elizabeth Blackwell, whose father, because he was a Quaker, insisted that his daughters have an equal education to their brothers. And the same thing with Harriet Beecher Stowe.
Yep, I was thinking of Harriet.
And some of these others. And, you know, it was the fathers insisting that, you know, their daughters can be educated. I had a father like that, that there was no difference. And, you know, I'd say, Dad, what are the limitations on my life? He's like, you don't have any and you can do anything. And so it's like, oh, okay, that kind of leaves everything really wide open, Dad. You know, can you narrow it down? But it does allow for extraordinariness. It really does.
Well, and it's based right there in Jesus, because we all know that Jesus was the one who elevated women to the equality that they deserved within the culture of that time. And, you know, Ramabai's father was not a Christian, obviously. He was a Hindu scholar, but he saw within his Hindu scriptures, no, we need to educate and we need to establish her gifts. We need to allow them to flourish. And we're cutting off our... We're cutting off our hands. We're hurting our society when we don't use all of the gifts, talents, and abilities that God has put within both men and women. Mm-hmm. And Anant Donje recognized that, and he lived that, and he suffered for that. That is why his family ended up starving, because the people in charge at the time didn't like a man who was saying that women were equal to men. So there she was. She was a very determined woman. I mean, she had only her own skills, her own abilities. She had thrust aside the faith of her childhood, but she'd run into some Christian missionaries and they taught her the Bible, and she looked at the Bible and she didn't understand it. They gave her a Bible to read. It didn't make no sense within the religious context in which she had certainly jammed her brain with all those Puranas. But she did recognize that there was something different about Christianity, particularly the story of the Samaritan woman. Mm. How did Jesus speak to that Samaritan woman? He treated her honorably, and he gave life to her. And she began to think, well, maybe there's something going on there. So, but she did have this platform, this education platform. And so she moved from Calcutta all the way across the continent to Bombay. And there she knew that a Marathi widow, because her caste, if you will, outside of the Brahmins, was she was Marathi. They were allowed to live in public and they weren't confined to their homes like the widows were in other parts of India. So she's taking these steps. She's educated enough. She's been all over the continent. She knew where she could raise her child without being, you know, shoved into something she didn't want to do. She had some relatives, not a whole lot.
And she didn't throw herself on the funeral pyre when her husband was, died. Yes.
She had jettisoned her Hinduism So while she was there in Bombay, she continued speaking because she was notable. And she founded a society for the education of women called the Arya Mahila Somaj. You'll forgive my...
Oh, no, that was impressive.
Well done. Skills are not there for that language.
We wouldn't know the difference, would we, Cheryl? You're fine.
So she would speak to small groups of British women, higher caste Hindu women. She was basically like a Bible woman. You know, she could get into enclaves where men couldn't get into. And she became so well known that the colonial government, again, it's the British government of India at the time, appointed her to the Hunter Commission, tasked with investigating Indian education. She had gone a long way in, 25 years? Small child. She began studying English at this time, realizing, which would have been her eighth language, realizing that that was going to be the key to her being able to speak better to power in India at the time. And she wanted to study in England. She realized that that was a key, right? Elizabeth Blackwell, about the same time, there were women who were emancipated enough to be able to be educated in England. And so this group of British women began to encourage her. She wrote a book. Let's see, the first book to pay for her trip was called Morals of Indian Women. And she was, again, arguing against Suti and other traditions that said a woman wasn't an equal.
Now, this is interesting because she's writing a book and most of the women in India at this time are illiterate. So it's mainly men that are going to buy this book. And I find that fascinating that she was able to, you know, generate an income from a book like that, that men would only buy, you know.
Well, I mean, again, the British colonial system and Queen Victoria knew about her, was encouraging this, because I think at that time, surely the Brits knew that the only way to help this enormous country they were trying to manage was to have a learned population. You can't sever half of your population and keep them in ignorance, throwing themselves on funeral pyres or going into seclusion without there being a notable, well, it's obviously totally misogynistic, but that's them. Yeah. So they were encouraging this.
I'm just really curious, which of her eight languages did she write it in? Her mother tongue?
Yeah, that's what I was wondering, yes.
What, the most familiar, or was it in English? Because something like that I could see getting into Britain and having that effect of changing the minds of the people in society of what should be done in India.
Well, you can buy it right now on Amazon.
Really? Oh, that's wonderful.
Wow.
Oh, I love it. I love it when an author's book is still in print 100 years later.
Yeah. The only problem is you go to Amazon.
Years later.
Yeah. You go to Amazon. I tried to do that with Amanda Berry Smith. And I was like, I want to get her book. And it's like, oh, it's $2,000. And we happen to have one copy. You're like, that's okay. I found it on Kindle for free. So I was like, okay. But, you know, they can be expensive. Mm-hmm.
Well, notably, she was able to sell enough copies that she had enough money to get to England. But again, she was also encouraged by the group of British women in the society there in Bombay that she was moving in, and the missionaries who taught her English. So she earned enough money. She went off to England, and she arrived in early 1883, where she stayed with a religious order. Maybe, Cheryl, they're still there. I don't know. They're called Sisters at Wantage.
But you know what? We need to take a break. This is about all we can do on this particular episode. We're down to 1 minute.
And we will be back.
But I...
Don't leave, Michelle.
Yeah,
we want to hear the rest.
Yes, you've got to come back because this is so fascinating. So this is great because we've got her to England. How old is she at this point?
1883, she would be 26-ish, 27.
26. She's already knows seven languages. She's teaching herself eight being English.
Eight.
And so she's, and these ship voyages, and, you know, no doubt just selling that, she's not traveling first class. And boat voyages were, you know, and especially for an Indian woman, were not a luxury. They were hard and it's long because that's like 1,000 miles by sea.
And I wonder if everybody thought she was a servant. Like, why else should she be on a boat, right?
Yeah, and, you know, no doubt she's probably in the quarters where you are on hammocks, not on staterooms, and there's so much to this. I can't wait to come back and hear more about Pandita. I have heard with the hearing of the ear, but now we're getting the real story. I love this. So thank you, Michelle, and I can't wait for next week.
Thank you for listening to Women Worth Knowing with Cheryl Broderson and Robin Jones Gunn. For more information on Cheryl, visit CherylBroderson.com or follow her on Instagram or Facebook. For more information on Robin, visit RobinGunn.com or follow her on Instagram or Facebook. Join us each week for a lively conversation as we explore the lives of well-known and not so well-known historical and contemporary Christian women. If you think there is a woman worth knowing, we'd love to hear from you. Email us at WWK@cccm.com. We hope you've enjoyed today's episode. Make sure you rate us on your podcast app, subscribe, and share it with a friend. Thank you again for listening to Women Worth Knowing with Cheryl Broderson and Robin Jones Gunn. Women Worth Knowing is a production of Calvary Chapel, Costa Mesa.